Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this FedSoc Forum discussing ABA accreditation. My name is Libby Dickinson, and I'm an Assistant Director with the Federal Society's Practice Groups and Networks. As a reminder, all opinions expressed are those of the speaker and not of the Federalist Society. Our moderator today is Michael McGinnis, Professor of Law and J. Philip Johnson Faculty Fellow at the University of North Dakota School of Law. If you have any questions throughout the webinar that pertain to the topic at hand, please submit them through Zoom's Q&A feature located at the bottom of your screen, not the chat, so that we'll be able to access them later after the discussion. With that note, I will hand things over to Professor McGinnis. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Libby, and thank you to the Federalist Society for making this opportunity for discussion available. Our topic is moving away from ABA accreditation. The Council on the ABA section of Legal Education Admissions to the Bar has long been the only federally recognized accreditor for law schools. In that role, it is able to direct what law schools teach and determine what constitutes sufficient coursework for law students. Over the past several years, the ABA has faced several challenges to proposed directives for law school, including a recent proposal to increase the requirement of clinical hours, which has since been withdrawn, and various policies that have been labeled DEI initiatives. Some have lauded these efforts, while others have expressed concern that they mistake the purpose of law schools. In light of skepticism about the ABA, some state bars, particularly Florida and Texas, have opted to no longer require their students to have attended an ABA-accredited law school in order to sit for their bar exams. In light of these and other efforts, voices from across the political spectrum have debated not just the value of the particular ABA policy directives, but the appropriate role of the ABA as an accreditor. Our excellent panel this afternoon will be discussing these arguments about the ABA. And so I'm going to introduce them. It's my privilege to introduce them in the order in which they'll be opening with their remarks. And after they do those remarks, there'll be a moderated Q&A between the panelists discussion. And then finally, at the end of the program, as Libby noted, we'll open it up for the Q&A that we'll read from the audience questions. So with no further ado, it's first my pleasure to introduce Professor Derek Muller from Notre Dame Law School. He is a nationally recognized scholar in the field of election law. His research focuses on the role of states in the administration of federal elections, the constitutional contours of voting rights and election administration, the limits of judicial power in the domain of elections, and the Electoral College. He's published more than 24 academic works, and his op-eds have appeared in the New York Times, the LA Times, and the Wall Street Journal. He is a co-author of a federal courts case book published by Carolina Academic Press, and also a co-reporter on the new restatement of the law, election litigation, an effort led by the American Law Institute. He also has a blog, an excellent one, called Excess of Democracy, where he has examined issues relating to the ABA Law School standards for accreditation. Next, our next panelist is Professor Daniel Rodriguez. He's the Harold Washington Professor of Law at the Northwestern University Pritzker School of Law. He was served as the dean of the law school from January 2012 through August of 2018. His principal academic work is in the areas of administrative law, local government law, statutory interpretation, federal and state constitutional law, and the law-business technology interface. He has also offered significant commentary over the years on proposed ABA standards relating to accreditation. So I'm very interested to hear his remarks as well. He was also the 2014 president of the Association of American Law Schools and currently serves as the chair of the Council of the ABA Center for Innovation, a council member for the American Law Institute, and an advisor to Ross Intelligence Incorporated. And finally, we are honored to have with us today Daniel Thies. He was a shareholder at the law firm of Weber & Thies in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. Prior to joining the firm, he was an associate at Sidley Austin LLP and clerk for Chief Judge James F. Holderman of the United States District Court for the Northern District of Illinois, and for Judge Jerry Smith of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. Mr. Thies is currently the chair of the Executive Committee of the Council of the ABA Section of Legal Education and Admissions to the Bar, the nationally recognized accrediting body for American law schools. He's also served as a member of the Finance and Governance Committees of the Council, the chair of the Standards Committee, and as chair of the Strategic Review Committee. So with that, I will now turn it over to Professor Muller to get us started.
Well, great. Well, thank you, Professor McGinnis, and appreciate being here. This should be a great conversation. So when we think about accreditation, thinking about the ABA in particular, there's obviously a lot of subtlety in how we think about these issues. When it comes to accreditation, we can think about what the Department of Education does, and we can think about what state bars do with respect to accreditation. That is, the Department of Education certifies a lot of entities, the Higher Learning Commission, the Middle States Commission on Higher Education, WASC, a number of these organizations, that once you are accredited by one of them, federal loan dollars flow through you. And so the ABA is one of those entities. We can spend some time maybe talking about that, but probably a lot more of the attention in recent years has been, or in recent months, has been focusing on the role of the ABA as gatekeeper to the bar. And that's largely because states like Texas and Florida, to a lesser extent Ohio and Tennessee in recent months, have been reconsidering this relationship between the ABA and what it means to get admitted to the bar in those jurisdictions. In every state, now except for Texas, in every state, the ABA, or graduating from an ABA-accredited school, is a will be sufficient in many states to sort of get you admission into the bar, and one of those things that would be acceptable as a basis to get into the bar. In a few states, like California, they recognize additional entities. So the California Supreme Court recognizes, and the bar recognizes, an additional group of schools that are not ABA-accredited. You graduate from one of them, you get accepted to the bar. But the vast majority of state courts over the last 40 years in particular have largely just said that if you graduate from an ABA-accredited school, you can get admitted to the bar. You still have to pass the bar exam, or you're waived in, or diploma privilege in states like Wisconsin. But that's the major condition that's put in place. Now, in recent years, as we're thinking about this, sort of the ABA accrediting legal programs for Department of Education funds and the ABA accrediting schools that state courts have recognized as a permissible basis or a sufficient basis to sort of demonstrate your credentials to get in, to take the bar and to be admitted to the bar, you know, there's friction that's arisen. So much of the friction has been with the American Bar Association as an entity. The American Bar Association has long faced allegations of bias, of liberal political bias, of rating Republican-appointed judicial nominees lower than Democratic judicial nominees. It's weighed in on the side of abortion rights and abortion interests. It's weighed in suggesting the Equal Rights Amendment is enacted as a part of the Constitution as the 28th Amendment. Now, those are things that sort of this parent organization does. It's true that separately, there's the section on legal education. It is formally separate. It's still on the website. It gets to use the ABA branding. There's some relationship between the House of Delegates of the ABA and what the section does. But there is a significant amount of separation. At the same time, the branding has been a significant problem if we're thinking about the label of the ABA. And that's what's gotten a lot of attention. And maybe we could spend some time thinking about that. But I think more importantly is a lot of the friction that's happened with state bars and law schools and thinking about the relationship of what the ABA does. So the ABA has extensive standards for accreditation, extensive standards. If you look at other organizations like the Higher Learning Commission, you know, the Higher Learning Commission will identify kind of four criteria with some subsets of criteria they want for schools, and then they kind of defer to the schools to demonstrate how they're in compliance with that. The ABA has dozens and dozens of pages with standards that get to, with excruciating detail, the expectations for what law schools are supposed to do. Some of those have been very controversial in recent years. For instance, the proposed amendments to Standard 206, which requires law schools to demonstrate by concrete actions commitments to diversity, inclusion, and access with a long list of protected characteristics. That since has been backpedaled under the Trump administration, and the section said we're not going to try to enforce that, but that's one of those kinds of rules. Other rules in recent years have been to suggest that learning outcomes in all course syllabi of the same course have to look identical. Professors have to undergo certain kinds of teacher training every 3 years. Schools have to re-examine their criteria for every 5 years for what those learning outcomes look like. The schools have to provide certain information to students. on and on the list goes. And most recently, last year, the proposal was to require schools to provide 15 units of experiential learning. None of that could be in the first year, or 12 units of experiential learning. None of that could be in the first year, with additional units that had to be in clinical or field placement work. Costly endeavors at many schools, admittedly costly under some of the evidence that had been provided and the empirical literature that's out there. And with all of these rules, there's not a lot of examination of the corresponding benefits. People suggest maybe there's survey data, maybe students feel better if they take certain evidence, or it's just common sense that certain things are in place. But each of these regulations comes with a cost, a regulatory cost, an oversight cost, whatever it might be. And increasingly, you have obviously contentious ones like the diversity, inclusion, and access rules. You have other ones that are sort of just ordinary, costly kinds of mechanisms. And a number of state Supreme Courts have begun to push back against the ABA as the sole or the exclusive or the default accreditor in these states. So the state of Texas has now said, we don't recognize the ABA anymore. It's replaced it with its own list, which matches the ABA's list. It might add or subtract from that in future years. And the Texas Supreme Court has said, we're going to have to try to come up with criteria. So we'll see what happens there. The Florida Supreme Court has said, we're still going to recognize the ABA, but we'll open ourselves up to recognizing other accrediting agencies. So this is closer to maybe what the California model does. And maybe we'll see what other states are doing. I think there are opportunities to think about alternatives and creative alternative solutions, but I would just highlight a couple of the problems that we're facing right now. The one is, even when one or two or several states want to deregulate, the incentives for basically all ABA-accredited law schools will be to remain ABA-accredited. And that is because of the reciprocity issue. That is, how do I get the graduates of my school to be able to practice in all 50 states? And if most states or many states require ABA accreditation, that is going to be a major, major barrier to sort of trying to take down, if you will, what some people have tried to suggest about the ABA. So there are going to be real limitations to how reform efforts move forward. Additionally, when we've seen efforts like California's to provide non-ABA accredited schools, they've typically not performed as well. They are less affordable, but they tend to have lower bar passage rates, lower employment outcomes, not always, but some. And this has been a long-standing experiment. So the question is how successful this might be in the long term. Now, the ABA has been responsive in recent years, again, to pressure from the Trump administration to withdraw its diversity initiative, to pressure or resistance from law school deans about this sort of new experiential learning requirement and so on. The question is how many more of these regulations or how many more consistent efforts to sort of micromanage the curriculum of law schools will continue to be at the fore before we continue to see the sort of dissolution at the state level and the pushback from the states. So I think I'll leave my opening comments there and we'll see how the dialogue goes. So thank you.
Thank you, Professor Mueller. Professor Rodriguez.
Thank you very much. And thanks to the Federal Society and the co-panelists for involving me in this. I want to take the advantage of going second to basically embellish on and riff on Derek's comments. He knows since I think it's a small but merry band of those of us who've been involved, whether from the inside or in our case, largely from the outside of on accreditation issues, talked about them, blogged about them and all of that. And I think that he and I see largely eye to eye on this, but I want to, again, just embellish on a few parts of it. And let me begin with, and here I'm borrowing from a much used observation that a notable political scientist made, I don't know, 20 years ago in speaking about Congress. But I'll use the same phrase to speak about the ABA and the accreditation. The ABA is a they, not an it. And so Derek already mentioned this, but let me just reinforce it. The big ABA, as it's called, the American Bar Association, of course, I'm going to say this in the most neutral way, although I'm sure it has a tenor to it, is a trade association. It's a group of lawyers that represents the interests of lawyers. And also, as he mentioned, has gone out on their skis over the years to take some positions, some quite controversial positions on a number of hot button issues. It's a Byzantine organization in many respects, like I suppose large groups are. It operates through two entities that no matter how many years I'm involved in ABA, I still have to look at a cheat sheet to understand the relative role of the Board of Governors of the ABA and the House of Delegates. But it's basically an association that for reasons that it's not worth boring this group with, many years ago, indeed many decades ago, hived off the accreditation function from the larger role of the ABA as a trade association. And so that role is played by the section on legal education and admissions to the bar, whose jurisdiction is largely driven by the council. Now, of course, there's more and less to that than meets the eye. How the connections between the ABA and the section are, as Derek mentioned, branding connections that are important and controversial in their own right. But they're not only branding conventions. There's some overlap. The ABA, big ABA, and the leadership of the ABA has a very substantial role and input into the selection of those who are involved with and work on behalf of the council. There's some formal rules and regulations that, again, aren't worth probably dwelling on here, that involve the role of the House of Delegates in, I think the magic term is acquiescing or not acquiescing in decisions made by the council. But at the end of the day, it's really the council speaking on behalf of the section that deals with the lion's share of issues that involve accreditation and gets the spotlight. The reason why it's worth unpacking the organizations as a they, not an it, and this is, again, implicit, I think, in why this subject has gotten quite a lot of scrutiny, is the section has been tagged with some of the controversies and some of the, you might say, ill odor from the vantage point of more conservative parts of the political spectrum, decisions made by the ABA. But what's interesting to me as an old timer in these debates, someone who's been watching legal education and led a couple of law schools and all of that, is the controversy over the role and function and content of the ABA accreditation rules did not begin with the Trump administration, did not begin a few years ago, has been enduring, it's had its ups and downs for long, long periods of time. And the focal point, again, I'm borrowing here on what Derek has always said, the focal point of this criticism has been largely, almost entirely, the sense among many, most law schools that the ABA accreditation requirements are overbearing and in many respects anachronistic, and some particularly worse from the vantage point of law schools than others. Derek mentioned a couple that have encountered some rather significant, severe scrutiny, some sort of almost hot off the presses because they haven't been around for all that long, like the requirement of learning outcomes, some that have ebbed and flowed, but have reached a particular salience, particularly in recent years. The diversity requirements, not only the diversity requirements as stated, but how the diversity requirements have been implemented. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that a bit more. And the experiential learning requirement, which before the proposal for 12 credits, which he noted has been withdrawn, but if you read the fine print, the ABA did require 6 experiential learning credits, clinical credits, not all that long ago. But a couple that he didn't mention that I think it's worth mentioning here that have been the subject of some amount of criticism over the years and are quite unusual with respect to accreditation bodies of professions generally. One is essentially the control and rules and regulations governing the labor market for teaching, which is to say the requirements of a full-time faculty that and with not only the bells and whistles, but with some of the criteria of governance and security of employment and all of that, that has been hard baked into those ABA accreditation rules. So law schools that might have, for cost reasons, for pedagogical reasons, for social reasons, want to have a faculty composed of practicing lawyers primarily, and judges and others, persisted for many, many years in the history of legal education, are not permitted to do so. The other is, and here I owe some credit to my colleagues who've pointed this out, having experienced accreditation across the board. To the best of my knowledge, the legal profession, that is the ABA Council, is the only organization that requires a valid and reliable admissions test as a criterion for admission in law school. So, and there are others as well. So I just think it's important to emphasize that rather than imagine that the controversy over ABA accreditation requirements has recently emerged during the first and now the second Trump administration, in fact, law schools have been banging the drum and banging at the doors with respect to the council over many leadership tenures and over many managing directors for many, many years. I mentioned overbearing, but let me look at the other end of the spectrum. There's also been criticism voiced about the ABA accreditation, the council, that it's been, is this a term, underbearing? It's been incomplete, and that the stated criteria of output measures, and here I'm speaking of the requirement of certain percentage of graduates over a fixed period have passed the bar, has been incompletely enforced and maybe thinly enforced for many, many years. And for those, so for those who take the position that the section plays a very important role in setting standards of minimum competency and also disclosure, so that students and potential students have a sense of whether and to what extent a law school can provide not only a credible curriculum, but provide a pathway to actually pursuing the profession and paying off their debt, to put it directly, bluntly, have found that the ABA has over the course of a long period of time has been unreliable in policing and supervising the responsibilities of law schools. Again, we can talk more about that to see whether or not that's more of, by way of a trope or a myth rather than a reality. But suffice to say, that's been a point of controversy. I just want to make one other point by way of introductory comments, and I know we'll get into this in some depth and detail. While there's been, I wouldn't say a plethora, we're only really talking about two states and maybe technically one state, the state of Texas, and maybe the state of Florida on the verge of being the second state. By my count, that leaves 48 states that have not yet, as we speak here at the beginning of 2026, moved fast and furiously in the direction of developing separate admission standards, that is moving away from ABA accreditation. There'll be more to come. I suspect maybe Ohio will be the third, but whether and to what extent we will see a rush to race to the top or the bottom, I suppose, depends on one's perspective. I think it's still too early to tell. The point about reciprocity is a big issue. And the other issue is quite frankly, with all due respect to the legal leadership and the judiciary in Texas and Florida and other states, it takes a lot of work to develop admissions criteria and to manage that, and whether states will be able to, as it were, roll up their sleeves and really develop an intentional new system of accreditation remains to be seen. But I want to make this final point, and that is, or this final preliminary point, I guess, and that is, even if there's not a rush to states moving away from ABA accreditation, and Daniel can speak to this better than I think either Derek or I can, it certainly got the council's attention. Which is to say, if one of the consequences of this movement, whatever the origins and whatever we might think about the motivations and all of that, is to have the section through its council significantly revisit and engage in, as it were, blue sky thinking about the role and functions of accreditation, the content of the rules, how the rules are applied, I think that is long overdue and would be highly promising, as long as, without, and here I mean not to bury the lead, as long as it's a transparent process that involves multiple stakeholders, that involves the engagement of a diversity of law schools and stakeholders outside of the four corners of law schools. And so I have some guarded optimism and certainly some high hopes that we'll see in the coming months and the coming years a new and improved a scheme and system of the ABA accreditation before us for the benefit of really our students and law schools generally. So I'll stop there for now.
Thank you, Professor Rodriguez. Mr. Thies.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you to my co-panelists for setting the table so well. And let me start by saying, with Professor Rodriguez's last comments there, he's singing to the choir. I really do see this as an opportunity to make our system better, and we're always looking for help in that. Accreditation used to be a very sleepy corner of the world, and all of a sudden we've got all this attention, and by and large that's a good thing, because that means more smart people thinking about this, and I think we can, you know, take the best from thinking around the country and make the council process better than it is. So that's certainly our goal. Let me start by mentioning a few things about the separate and independent status of the council, since both of my co-panelists have brought that up. And that's the extent to which the council is separate and independent from what we might call the big ABA. And when we say that, I really think of three buckets as to what that means. One is that we choose our own membership. So there's actually a nominating committee within the section that identifies folks to serve on the council, identifies who the chair should be, Those nominations go to the section membership, not to the big ABA, and they are generally elected. The big ABA and the presidents and the leadership doesn't have anything to do with that process. The second thing is that we set our own policies. So that means we make all the accreditation decisions with respect to individual schools. It also means that we have the final say on the content of our standards, not the House of Delegates, not the ABA leadership. And then the third bucket is that we set our own budget. So we get to decide what we spend money on. The big ABA doesn't have anything to do with that. We don't give them any money. They don't give us any money. Right. So those are the three buckets. And this is not just an abstract concept on which you have to take my word for it. In fact, the Department of Education requires us to do all of those things. They have for a long time, and the council has never been found out of compliance with the department's separate and independent requirements. So you can take that as the third party validation of those points. Now, the council has been accrediting law schools since 1921. And we've been recognized by the Department of Education as the only national accreditor for the JD degree since the 1950s. Over time, as my panelists alluded to, more and more states have relied on our accreditation to decide who can sit for the bar. And as of today, graduates from council accredited schools can sit for the bar in all 50 states. Now, Texas has been brought up, and I would just note at the moment, Texas has said, we, the Texas Supreme Court, get to decide which schools are accredited. True, that's always been true. And then they go on to say our list is 197 schools long, and it's the same list as the council's list of 197 schools. So at the moment, again, all 50 states recognize graduates of council accredited schools to sit for their bar. This structure of having one national accreditor is not an accident. In fact, it's extremely important to the profession and to the public for at least three reasons. The first of those is portability. And this means that a prospective law student doesn't have to know where he or she is going to practice when applying to law school. And as you might expect for young aspiring lawyers in their 20s, this is a very good thing because they don't yet know where life is going to take them. Family or career opportunities might lead them to settle in a state different than what they expected at first. And it's extremely valuable to them to be able to go to any accredited law school and still end up anywhere in the country. That's also, of course, important to employers who are able to hire from a much bigger pool of graduates across the country. So in 2024 alone, just to give an example, 10 states report this data. And out of those 10 states, 25% of the individuals who passed a bar exam, that's over 6,000 individuals, graduated from an out-of-state council-accredited law school. So that gives you a sense of the demand for portability. That's only 10 states. So that's number one, portability. Number two is that the council's work ensures quality. We make sure that every graduate of schools accredited by us receives a quality of education that allows them to join the bar and then go on to competently and ethically serve their clients and the public. And the proof of the efficacy of our process for this purpose is in the pudding. Council accredited law schools, graduates of those schools are three times more likely to pass the bar exam than graduates of non-council accredited law schools. Now, to Professor Rodriguez's concern, or he at least mentioned this concern is out there of us being, quote, underbearing, right? Maybe we're not doing enough. I would point you back to what the council did in the years following the recession. Now, during that time, lots of law schools started throwing open the doors and admitting more students than they should because demand for law school went way down. And by 2014, 10 law schools had a 25th percentile LSAT score of their admits below 142. That's an extremely low score. However, the council responded, and in the three following years, nine of those schools were found out of compliance with our standards. And thereafter, a total of nine schools either closed or lost their accreditation. Now, some of those schools were also sued during that period for exploiting students, which I think shows the importance of the council's reaction in that era. So that's the second reason. Third would be data collection. And this one is often overlooked, but a national accreditor can gather the same data in the same format from all law schools and can put in place audit procedures to ensure that that data is accurate. This is extremely useful to prospective students who can look at things like admissions requirements, bar passage rates, and graduate employment and compare them across all law schools in a consistent manner. Websites like Law School Transparency and ranking systems like U.S. News rely on our data that's gathered in a uniform manner in order to help prospective law students decide where to go to law school. And this is, in fact, been one of the most important parts of the council's work over the last decade. Again, going into the recession, law schools did not report this data consistently, and much of what they did report was inaccurate. For example, counting the graduate who works at Starbucks as fully employed. But the council came in again and corrected that abuse and put forth a uniform set of criteria so that now prospective law students have reliable employment data to rely on. Obviously, a large group of different regional accreditors would not be able to do the same thing. Now, the panel proposes moving away from council accreditation. And if I could reframe the question slightly, I really think it's important to ask, is it possible for somebody else to do the job of the council? Now, this is not a new topic. As my co-panelists mentioned, different states have considered alternatives to council accreditation for a long time. California, maybe most prominently, but also Tennessee recognizes Nashville School of Law, which is unaccredited. Purdue Global is an unaccredited law school that's recognized in Indiana and Connecticut. The Mass School of Law, their graduates can sit for the bar in most of the New England states. And so this has been going on for a long time. In fact, the LSAC lists 32 law schools that are not council accredited, including some that are fully online. So keep in mind now, California in particular is a big state and lots of people want to practice there. And among our critics who say, oh, you know, there should be another accreditor out there that could emerge. And if only we didn't have this restrictive council accreditation, you know, innovation would flourish and we'd be in a much better position. Well, this has not happened so far in California. And that should be proof of the concept if it were going to happen. But in fact, those Cal Bar schools are the very schools where graduates pass the bar at one third of the rate of council accredited schools. And so if the goal is innovation plus quality, California, unfortunately, has not shown much innovation and it's lost the quality, which I think is a sort of a warning tale for those who are looking outside of the council for accreditation. Now, could an alternative national accreditor emerge from the various state-based processes that are going on, Texas, Florida, et cetera? Theoretically, yes, but not easily. One way, of course, would be through a system of reciprocity among state-based systems. And it's not clear that such a system would easily develop among multiple states. That path would require states like New York, Illinois, Massachusetts, or California to sign on to accrediting systems developed in Florida, Texas, or Tennessee. And the challenges there are obvious, I think. Another possibility was proposed in Florida's order, which is to recognize one of the Department of Education recognized institutional accreditors to accredit the professional degree in law. That would be groups like SACS or Western States, Higher Learning Commission. And the truth is there that those entities currently accredit universities more broadly, including everything from the humanities to economics to engineering. They don't have the expertise to accredit the professional degree in law. And professional accreditation is something different, because our degree qualifies you to pursue membership in the bar and to serve the public uniquely among higher education. The potential costs, finally, of abandoning a national system are illustrated by California's attempt to develop its own bar exam in February of 2025. And I'll urge you to look at the news reports of that effort, but in short, it was a disaster with all sorts of problems with administration and questions about the reliability and validity of the test. And it will likely cost the state bar over $6 million to ameliorate the harm caused to bar takers. And the state has, in fact, returned to the national exam, the NCBE-created exam, in 2025. So in closing, I'll say that if you don't like the council, the better path is to work with the council to improve its processes. And Professor Rodriguez mentioned this possibility. I have just recently appointed an advisory committee to help us take a look at our standards to figure out where we can improve them and make them better. We've incorporated onto that committee a member of the Florida Task Force on the council and also a member of the Texas Supreme Court. And in both cases, we are very sensitive to listening to the criticisms that are out there, including the criticisms of particular standards, some of which maybe we'll get to in questions. But in short, we are striving to be open. We're striving to be responsive, and we do want to make our system better. And I'd ask everybody listening to help us in that process. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Thies, and thanks all the panelists for your opening comments. I want to provide an opportunity for you to ask questions of each other first in response to the great ideas and thoughts that have been shared so far. So does anyone have a question for a fellow panelist that they'd like to open with, or just a comment to offer in response to anything you've heard from others?
I'll just make a short comment in response to Daniel's comment about California may being a natural experiment about innovation. I'll accept that point with respect to maybe the dearth of innovation on the part of the non-accredited schools. I don't know as I know enough to go through the, what is it, close to 20 schools to make observations about the lack or presence of innovation of those schools. I certainly accept the point about quality if measured by the bar exam, but I think it's a little bit, if I may, a bit of a non sequitur. The real question would be, in the absence of some of these, what I'll call the overbearing administrative and some quite unusual regulatory requirements imposed on all law schools, like the 12 credit, the potential, the putative 12 credit experiential learning requirement, the requirement of an admissions test, the requirement of full-time faculty and all of that. It would be interesting to see how many law schools might actually innovate. Some questioner in the Q&A just put a point about online law schools that the ABA has been rather tepid historically about improving. So that would be really where we could see, if not 1,000 flowers bloom, then maybe several dozen flowers bloom, is let's just see whether law schools innovate in the space left by a set of thinner and maybe more output related regulatory requirements. That I think would be a true test of whether we would see innovation in legal education, which is long overdue.
Thank you, Professor Rodriguez. Professor Mueller.
Yeah, I want to pick up a point on the California point. I was in California for 9 years teaching, and I acknowledge the point that for many of those schools, they do not attract the same caliber of student. And I think this is part of the problem in trying to assess quality, right? That is, if the quality of the incoming students is materially lower than the ABA-accredited schools, well, it's not really about the schools, it's really about their ability to attract candidates. And the reason why they're not really able to attract as high caliber of candidates is because graduates of those schools are required to be in one state. It's a signal to employers. Maybe it's right or wrong, but there are real questions in sort of teasing out what is sort of driving the problems in a lot of the California law schools. In the aggregate, I would say there are major problems with the California accredited schools, but at the individual level, and I always come back to an example of a school called San Joaquin, which serves the Fresno market, which is an extraordinarily large legal market in California that has no other law schools nearby. It is a California accredited school. It has a bar passage rate that consistently outperforms multiple ABA schools in the state. It has tuition about half the price of a typical school in the state, and it gets a lot of judges and a lot of personnel who are willing to be there. It caters to a niche market, absolutely. Additionally, the California rules for accreditation, they're pretty close to the ABA rules. They're requiring 3 years of legal education. You have to pass you have to get through all these hoops. You have to jump through a lot of the same kinds of things you would require if you were in an ABA accredited school. So if we're thinking about innovation and whether, as Professor Rodriguez indicated, online education, okay, I can be skeptical about online education, but if we're thinking about innovation or permissibility, if we want to think about two-year legal programs or legal programs where there's a high apprenticeship component to them, experiential capstones at the end of a legal education that don't require in-person residency, there are all kinds of ways in which you might develop alternative models of legal education to get people qualified for the bar, see if they pass the bar, and if they're passing the bar at a high rate, the proof would be in the pudding there. But those kinds of things are essentially forbidden under the existing sort of static 3 years, number of other things that you have to jump through in order to be able to achieve it. Now, again, some schools try to circumvent this with 2.5 and 2 years by compressing some of the credits and getting them through the summer and things like that. But these are sort of workarounds. This is a Rube Goldberg approach. So I would just resist drawing too much from the California experiment. I think that when we're trying to suss out quality of schools, the sort of value add turns a lot on the inputs, and there are reasons why candidates are drawn to schools that do have that national reciprocity and those schools that do have the brand recognition in ways that they're not going to be catering to other alternative models. And we'll see, you know, if states like Florida or Texas begin to recognize additional schools, you know, maybe they're only going to be accredited for that state, or maybe there's going to be a consortium of sort of an alternative model that California and Texas and Florida and maybe Tennessee and Alabama, maybe a few states will recognize these schools. And so I agree it's a big challenge. And I'll only sort of close by indicating I'm optimistic too, to some degree, thinking about what the reform efforts might look like. But again, I think there have been major challenges over the years about reforms. A lot of times people get together with the best of intentions, and then it's new and additional regulations. And if that's going to be sort of the constant mantra, I wonder what's going to come down the line. We'll see.
Thank you, Professor Miller. Mr. Thies, do you have any thoughts in response to those comments?
Yeah, so maybe I can jump in now on the point about overregulation. And there's a lot that I could be said about that. In general, I disagree that we have overbearing regulation. I do appreciate that my panelists have not trouted out the old canard that we require a certain number of degrees or of books in the library. That has been long gone for decades, and yet you still see that on blog posts. So I appreciate that. But in general, let me address the criticism more broadly by pointing to one of our processes that doesn't get enough attention, which is the variance process. And we've got a standard 107 that says if a school has an idea about how they can do legal education better than what the standards require, they can apply for a variance. And in my experience on the council, which goes back to 2008, these variances are very broadly and widely granted. Distance education, for example, when it was more of a new idea, the council very early on granted a few distance education variances. And I think the distance education programs that we have today, in large part, are building on that innovation. And the standards themselves have been opened up in that area because of those variances. We're currently in the middle of a variance process with several dozen schools trying alternatives to the admissions test requirement, right, that Professor Rodriguez mentioned. And, you know, if those experiments go as the proponents of not using admissions tests would want, we're very likely headed to doing away with that standard as well, based on that data-driven process, driven by the schools who see a better way of doing things, right? So within the current accreditation process, you can innovate, you can do different things. I'd also say, again, keeping at the big picture, and we can talk about particular standards if you want, but there are two pressures on the council that any accreditor in this space would face. And those are, number one, the Department of Education, which has been mentioned. The department has its own list of things that our standards has to include. And it includes things like the self-study requirement, standard 204, which law schools love to hate. But that's not us. That's the department. They require us to have that. Standard 310, which talks about how you count credit hours. Again, that's not us. The department requires us to have that standard. The requirement of measuring learning outcomes. That's a department requirement. Now, we have some discretion in how we implement it, but that's something the department requires us to do. Putting law schools through the process of applying for substantive change. Again, that's not us. That's the department. And some of the more restrictive requirements about distance education that are still in our standards are, again, things dictated by the department. So that's one thing. Any accreditor that comes in is also going to have to deal with those. The second thing is the state Supreme Courts. And we have not mentioned it yet, but the state Supreme Courts recently put together a task force called the Committee on Legal Education and Admissions Reform, or CLEAR. And I urge everybody listening to go out and read their report because it's very informative and interesting. And they say a lot of things about the way the courts are looking at the regulation of the legal profession. In this space, though, they are actually calling for more practical education, not less. So, you know, the state Supreme Courts, again, those are the people in charge. Ultimately, they decide who sits for the bar. And there is certainly not a unanimous chorus of the state Supreme Court justices, but a very large majority of them are pushing for more practical education in order to make sure that graduates are practice ready. So, you know, our proposal to increase the number of experiential learning credits required was mentioned. It has been withdrawn, but those pressures are still there. And any other accreditor, again, that wants to play in this space, and particularly anyone who wants to become a national accreditor, is also going to have to deal with those pressures. So there are more vectors that cause our standards to be what they are than just that, oh, those folks over there at the council are not being responsible. And we should keep that in mind as we think about how to make the system better.
Thank you, Mr. Thies. I have a question I'll just put out based on a couple of the comments that have said before we turn to if there's additional questions among the panelists and then the Q&A. There's been discussion about portability. I think that's, you know, in thinking about the first movers here, you have Texas and Florida. And then there's this challenge about how to, you know, deal with the reciprocity question, how to actually make that practically work if there was a desire from some states to do so. What is the, I guess, I just throw this out for anyone on the panel who wants to answer this. What is the biggest impediment to that kind of coordination? In other words, is it going to require a state like Texas to invest in, here's going to be our standards, and then other states could simply say, well, we agree with Texas, we'll just piggyback on whatever they're doing. But that seems to put a lot of onus on them to have the apparatus in place and the expense of that. And you'd also, I guess, it could have the other issue, which is you'd have certain states, you know, to the extent there's a sort of a political element that's involved here in terms of states either sympathy or lack sympathy for the ABA organization as a whole, as a trade association, whether you might get, I think Mr. Thies alluded to this, sort of clusters where there's like, you may get Texas and Florida and certain other states on board, but you weren't going to get New York and Illinois, who may be more sympathetic with ABA as an institution. Anyway, just put that out there for thoughts about sort of the practical challenges and whether there is a prospect, if you get some momentum from a first mover, to have something that will work with a fairly streamlined, simplified set of standards that give more flexibility than perhaps exists under the current regime.
Well, I'll just say, I think that's exactly right. I think that's the problem. I think, suppose Texas says, here's our standards, here's a new set of standards we have, and Texas will now give its seal of approval to schools that meet that. They're going to have to do that for 197 schools. They're going to then have to do it for a handful of additional schools that want to apply and figure out that they have a consistent standard. And then they have to figure out whether or not any other states are going to accept it and say, this is the right standard. And so part of it is, there is this first mover problem. And then sort of the acceptance that other courts have. Now, you can imagine Texas doing it and then Florida saying, we like that, we're going to adopt the same kind of standard and we're going to recognize our own schools. But then if Texas has recognized them, we'll also recognize their schools. And so maybe you start splitting the responsibility. But this becomes very hard to do in a silo, right? And so again, one of the things that the ABA has right now as a strong advantage is the ability to coordinate this, because everyone has sort of given the authority to the ABA to sort of set those standards, as once you've been accredited by the ABA, you're okay to come to our state. The alternative is trusting one state that develops the standards or whatever it might be. So it's going to be a much more difficult challenge in terms of getting everyone on board. As Mr. Thies pointed out, I think, yeah, there are efforts to sort of people to come together and suggest alternatives and alternative models and ways that the CLEAR report identifies ways forward. I would push back a little bit, at least thinking about that. Again, the CLEAR report, respect a lot of the people who are on it, but one of the objectives in the CLEAR report is one of the three groups was designed to find practice readiness. When you create a group that says we care about practice readiness, you are sort of already putting a thumb on the scale of saying we care about this output and this is the kind of thing we're going to put into our report, which becomes then sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy if we're trying to think about what we're trying to accomplish. So a lot of the results that come out of it, not denying that many states care about that and that they want to talk about that. But this is, again, one of the challenges about if one state wants to do something, are others on board? If you create a new consortium, are they just going to create some of the same problems that we have as we're trying to debate the consensus with respect to the ABA standards?
Thank you. Any other thoughts on that from other members of the panel?
I agree with everything Derek said. I'll leave it to Daniel. Yeah.
Yeah, I do. I do as well. And would just emphasize that the council does not take, you know, sort of the entrenched status that it has already as a reason for complacency. Right. We do understand that we can be better. We do understand that we have no intrinsic authority on our own. It's only to the extent that the state Supreme Courts rely on us that we have any authority to speak into the space at all. And so, you know, we're not lying down. We do want to make our process better. And I'll underscore that again.
Excellent. Well, we have some questions in the Q&A. I'll go ahead and turn to that unless there's some additional comments from the panel. Here's one. I'll read this for you. There was some discussion of the fact that the ABA is the only federally recognized accreditor for law schools, but the ABA only serves as a Title IV gateway for a small handful of schools. In other words, their NAC-IQI certification doesn't seem to play much of a role in getting schools to seek ABA accreditation compared to things like stated bar admission standards. Is there some other reason that the federal approval of ABA motivates schools?
No, please, Dan.
Go ahead. So the questioner is right that there's, in general, most law schools get their Title IV student lending authority from their regional accreditor, WASC or HLC or what have you. You know, that doesn't mean that if tomorrow the headline was Department of Education removes its recognition, that that wouldn't have an effect, right? And most immediately would have an effect in Florida, where the Supreme Court's order says, you know, we are now going to recognize graduates of any institution accredited by a body recognized by the Department of Education. So if the council lost its department recognition, the immediate consequence would be that in Florida, graduates of other council accredited schools would not be able to sit for the bar exam. Now, maybe the court would, you know, change its order at that point if that were to really happen, but that's a potential consequence.
Yeah, I would just add, and this embellishes on something that Derek said a moment ago, it's, I think, the coordination function and appeal, which is a strong appeal, relates to portability, relates to the, again, the labor intensive prospect of state by state accreditation, the difficulty of convergence, the reason why you have organizations like the Uniform Law Commission and the American Law Institute and the Conference of Chief Justices and others is because it's really difficult to imagine that one state, be it Illinois or California or Texas, is that's a model state. And if they do it, it must be something that we need to converge around. I think the American politics just does not allow itself to permit, from a practical vantage point, a first mover to become the mover on behalf of 49 states, he says cynically. And so the ABA does have as an organization, and you know, you can't beat something with nothing. And it's not obvious what the other organization would look like. Is it the Federal Trade Commission? Is it, you know, another entity? It's not obvious what would supplant the ABA section in that regard. If there were to be a national accredited organization.
Sure. Thank you. Here's another question. What are the panel's thoughts on jurisdictions removing the ABA accreditation requirement from their admissions by motion rules? I'm sorry, their admission by motion rules. For example, instead of requiring a degree from an ABA accredited school, an admission by motion rule could require receipt of a Juris Doctor or equivalent degree from a law school approved by another state or the District of Columbia. What potential problems or unintended consequences do you see with this type of workaround? I'm understanding the question, maybe they're driving at, maybe for new graduates, you require the same accreditation, but maybe allow, once they've been in practice for a number of years, then you don't have the same ABA standard, ABA Council accreditation requirement. Any thoughts on that question?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, and Daniel, you might, that's a state bar rule, right? That's not an ABA rule. I don't think the ABA has, the council has any position on admission to motion for practicing lawyers, but I'm happy to be corrected. If that's,
yeah, no, that's exactly that. What I would have said. It's not a state bar necessarily, but the state Supreme Courts in each.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Yeah, state,
you know, Supreme Court. Yeah. Decide that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you could imagine a system where if you are concerned about the quality of the graduates and their ability to pass the bar, and you think ABA accreditation is going to be a better benchmark for that. Again, assuming it's separate and apart from bar passage, right? Because we're assuming that passing the bar is not enough. It has to be passing the bar plus attending an ABA accredited school. If you wanted to apply by motion after some period of years of practice, and then you can demonstrate I haven't been subject to discipline and things like that, if we're thinking about measures of quality, then maybe presumably some years down the line, that's a better indicator, a better marker than thinking about your educational pedigree. So if schools are looking to reform their pathway to licensure, it would be a small set, right? Because if you have to practice a number of years and then leave the state and go into another state to practice, it would be a way of sort of opening things up. I think, again, a small one, and then thinking about what is the value of thinking about these extra conditions above and beyond having passed the bar. That's kind of our question here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Excellent. Next question. How can reform to ABA accreditation or innovation to other accreditor bodies address the problem of legal deserts in rural communities? Attending ABA accredited schools results in relocation from rural community because of the lack of distance learning and lack of affordability that further discourages students from rural communities returning to rural areas to practice because of loans. So is there a way that if we're talking about innovating or doing reforms of the accreditation standards as they currently exist, you know, how might that impact or be able to impact in a positive way legal desert questions? Any thoughts from any members of the panel on that?
Yeah, so the distance learning, I think, is promising here. And in fact, there are several fully online programs at accredited law schools now. I'm thinking of one at St. Mary's in San Antonio, for example. And most of those programs are relatively new, such that we don't have kind of robust bar pass data from them. But I'm optimistic. I think that that experiment in general is going well, and that it would be very promising if somebody could, in a rural area, could, you know, not give up their job, not give up their elder care or child care responsibilities, stay in the rural area, get a law degree, and then start practice. That could really make a dent in the rural access to justice problem.
I agree, and I would only add that so would some revision of the ABA's requirements with respect to criteria of a full-time faculty. To imagine that it takes a full-time faculty, you know, with all of the governance rights and others that are embedded in the ABA requirements to teach online seems somewhat anachronistic. And again, I know the ABA is rethinking that, and part of the process of revisiting that might yield some innovation in that regard. And I commend the ABA and commend Daniel and the leadership of the section for really moving ahead, full speed ahead, with the reconsideration of these existing rules. But I want to say, if I can just add a footnote that apropos something Derek said, it would be, I don't want to call it a tragedy, it would be a shame if what comes out of this process is, oh, there's some new rules. So for example, AI is really a big deal. We should have some new regulatory rules dealing with AI, or rule of law is in peril. So we need some new rules governing rule of law. Rumor on the streets is that there are folks who might be proposing such rules. And I strongly urge the council to resist the temptation to use this as an opportunity to add new regulatory requirements.
And I want to you know, pick up on a point that Mr. Thies identified earlier, which is thinking about variances. And I appreciate that the section, especially with respect to admissions or with admissions tests, has been very flexible and deferential in thinking about schools coming forward and offering alternatives. But again, if we're thinking about how systems should be designed and thinking about nudges, it puts a lot of onus on the school to hold themselves out there and to demonstrate the plan and indicate how they're going to comply with it. And it's particularly hard if you're a new school. And if you're a new school saying, hey, we want to sort of rip up the old mold and do everything differently. So I appreciate it. And maybe it's more transparency from the ABA and thinking about the kinds of variances. And I know the website lists a lot of them and lists the approval process and lists those stages. But thinking about, you know, where the places where variances are problematic in terms of the things that are sort of core essentials that cannot be touched, and the things that are much more subject to negotiation if there's an easier way of addressing the variances side of things. But I appreciate thinking about variances as an alternative to think about some of the barriers or resistance that schools had in the past.
I'll just throw in a question or a comment and see what if there's responses to it. And it's something raised by a number of the Q&A as well, you know, because of the ideological concern, right? This idea that there's at least a perception that, and some grounds for it, that some of the ABA ethos, as far as these various issues, DEI or other questions, has sort of found its way into the standards. And so that even if there is this independence operational way and significant structural ones, maybe not complete separations structurally, but because there is ABA membership required and section membership, but that there, it's seeped its way into the standards. So I'm thinking about the core principles and values that came out back in the fall. And I know Derek, I'm sorry, Professor Baller, you wrote a piece on the excess of democracy, commenting on some of those. And, you know, one involves economic exploitation. It uses the term rule of law, that they uphold the rule of law. A lot of contested questions. I think one of the challenges may be if there's going to be reform and revisions in the accreditation standards that currently exist, to what extent they can be some greater assurances that they're ideologically neutral. And so how, not only in how they're designed, but how they're applied to different schools with different approaches to these questions and faculty who have different ideas about these questions. Any thoughts or comments? We're almost out of time, but
I know I'll make my comment quick, because I know we're running out of time. You know, the ABA can be, and the council included, a very clubby organization. I've been on the nominating committee, and there tends to be the usual folks who are involved in this process. And to the extent that they historically tilt more toward the left of the political spectrum, I think that's true, and have ideological priors, it is incumbent upon the organization, that's both the big ABA, but I think they're a lost cause, but the ABA section, to have a diversity of viewpoint, ideological diversity, and be intentional about that, so that the folks who are actually in the room, as it were, not only developing standards, but implementing those standards, reflect, again, eclectic viewpoints, unconventional viewpoints, and don't begin or end with ideological priors that drive law school standards in one political direction.
Yeah, and let me say, I'm totally appreciate this concern, and I understand an accreditor and ideology should not be in the same sentence, right? Because, and particularly not in law. And so this is something that we are looking at as we're considering, you know, changes and reforms to our systems and the structure of how it gets put together. I will say, you know, in recognition of how important this is in law in particular, the standard has recently adopted as a standard on academic freedom, an interpretation of which says it is extremely important for law schools to invite all viewpoints and to be ideologically neutral, and students learn from the give and take. And so that's something we're very much focused on, and we recognize that needs to be reflected in our processes as well.
Thank you. I see Libby has appeared.
Yes. Well, I just wanted to jump back in to say thank you all so much for joining the panel today, for sharing your expertise and insights into this very important topic. Thank you to Professor McGinnis for moderating today's conversation. If our audience is interested in learning more about all of our programming that we do here at the Federalist Society, please visit our website at fedsoc.org. That is FEDSOC.org. Or feel free to send us your feedback. We always love to hear it at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you so much. Have a great afternoon.
Thanks so much, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.